are the Dolores Claiborne Minute, where I recap 1 minute from the film every week, exclusively on Radio Free Brooklyn.
Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Two men on a dream vacation.
What the hell are they doing?
I sure think they killed her.
Back! Frank, they've seen us.
And get trapped in an unbelievable nightmare.
Turn off the light!
Why? What's wrong? What are you guys up to?
20th Century Fox presents Race the Devil.
We saw somebody murdered.
What?
Some sort of ritual across the river. A girl got stabbed.
They're chasing us.
Starring Peter Fonda and Warren Oates. There was nowhere they could hide.
Alice, look what was stuck to the back window.
It's some kind of message. Witchcraft.
Witches!
There was no one they could trust.
Daddy, I killed my dog.
Well, did anybody hear anything? Didn't anybody see anything?
Go on with your trip. Have a good time. Leave this up to me.
There was nothing they could do.
He followed us all the way from Bandera.
Hey, everybody.
Here right now,
you're listening to Into the Dark. If you like the shows you're listening to, why not contribute to our Patreon at radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. See you guys at the back end of the theme music. Stay tuned for more Into the Dark.
And fight.
Shoot it, Frank!
And race with the devil.
There's somebody on top!
Frank!
Skeptic among believers, and the believer among skeptics.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Who are the witches?
Magic, necromancy, and witchcraft.
Wake up! They're all about you! All around you!
They're not always evil.
The often erotic world of the witch.
The journalist with an inside knowledge of witchcraft.
It's a sex thing deep down, of course.
Hey everybody, welcome to Into the Dark, the show that takes you to the every witchy where and when you've ever wondered about. We have a really exciting show for you today because we've got Lisa Marie Basile in the studio. So Lisa, if you don't know, but you should know, but now you're going to know either way, is the founder and editor of Luna Magazine, a magazine that is producing amazing articles on art, feminism, opinion, sex, and the occult. And she's also the author of a number of great collections, including Andalusia, Apocryphal, and Warlock, and also the author of an upcoming novella from Clash, and also a witch. So, this is a treat and very exciting. Lisa, hello. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Cool. So I wanted to start off actually talking about Luna for like a hot sec that could last the entire show, but maybe won't. So a big part of like, I've been familiar with this magazine for a while, but I was perusing it rather intensely this morning, and I was wondering, when you founded this, was the occult always going to be a part of it, or was that something that grew naturally out of what you were doing?
When I founded it, actually, it was more occult heavy. It was in 2014 or 2013. It's so hard to remember now. But it was intended to be kind of occult focused in a major way. And it went from there, and it became more about personal essays and sex and identity. So actually, everything kind of grew out of the occult because we found that we had a number of people who are interested in writing not only about magic but about their lives and the intersection between the two. So we kind of branched out from there, and it's just gotten better and better, and we have a lot of amazing witches on staff and who contribute regularly.
I have to say, one of the things I really love about the magazine is the way in which it really does focus on magic in terms of daily practice and day-to-day stuff. Like I mean, you have articles on things like, I was looking like how to make a poppet, which, I mean, you know, I'm pretty well, you know, I'm at least waist deep in magic most of the time. And like, I remember looking at something on making mirror boxes someplace else, and they're like, you know, make a poppet of the person you're trying to curse. And I was like, oh, great. How have I gotten this far without knowing how to do that? But it's not only just stuff like that. I mean, like, there was this amazing article that I saw. how to a spell for body acceptance and appreciation. And I think that focus on not just like the exterior aspects of magic, like making things happen in the material world, but having like internal transformation is really important. And there are not a lot of sources for that out there.
Yes, that's what I love about doing Luna. And that's actually a writer named Laura Delorado. She's one of my best friends. And she was able to meld the craft with something that I think so many women and men are talking about, and it's body love. And yeah, I think it's pragmatic. So not only talking about the history of the occult and its various arms, but giving the reader something to actually, you know, do or think about, or some way to use it in a real way. I love that.
Yeah. And I mean, that's so vital, especially because I mean, so I'm curious, because like, I know you have an interest in ritual in the absence of, say, like the existence of, say, a god or the belief of anything sort of like that, that like that the ritual has value.
Yes.
In itself. And like, what space does ritual play in your life?
Oh, ritual is pretty much the bread and butter of my sanity. And it started because I grew up in a Catholic family. My grandparents are Italian Sicilian, super Catholic. And I was always brought to church, and I fell in love with, you know, the Eucharist and the blood and the body. And although I didn't like take my communion, I am not in a state of grace. I fell in love with the structure of ritual, even though I didn't necessarily believe. It felt grounding, and it gave me something to think about. And as I grew older and realized Catholicism is definitely not for me, I am not a Catholic, I am not into any structured religion, and I don't even know what I really believe, I felt that ritual element followed me. So as a witch, I believe that my will is my power. My belief in my will and my intention is my power. And so I always structure for myself rituals, whether I do them on like the new moon or the full moon or just on a really stressful day. I try to create like a step-by-step process that allows me to center my thoughts and direct my attention toward whatever it is that I need. I mean, I probably would do 2 to 3 rituals a week just to, you know, stay level, not go crazy.
So, I mean, just to make the subtext explicit for a second, like, so these are rituals, you're creating these out of whole cloth or from scratch to some extent. Like, you're not going out and like finding these from so-called authorities or anything like that.
That's very true. I do not subscribe to any sort of, I don't necessarily believe that there's one kind of magic or belief or ideology that works for me. I think it's an eclectic melding of all of them, a little chaotic. And I primarily work with water, so I often do spells around the moon, as moon dictates water. So often my spells and rituals use water and journaling in some way. So I try to use water as my like vehicle to make my magic happen, and I use writing to kind of write out what I'm envisioning and what my intentions are. And then I create some sort of ritual around that, and it could be different every time. Sometimes I put the piece of paper that I write on into the water. Sometimes I put the water out under the moon, and then I kind of like use that water throughout the day. So it's both a ritual like in itself and something that I carry with me throughout the day or the week. So yeah, it's unstructured.
So this feels like a very personal and sort of intimate practice, but like, when did you start? Cause I mean, you've basically built this community of writers around Luna who I think a very high percentage of them would appear to be witches to some extent or another. So like, when did this shift from like a very personal private thing you were doing to reaching out and finding these people and putting them in a sort of more public space?
That's very interesting. It's so strange to me because although I'm creating this community and they're kind of congregating and building little communities between them too, I still keep my practice super personal. It's strange because I am creating a space for all these voices and their rituals and their ideas, but I rarely ever talk about my own practice to people, and I don't really practice with other people, and I'm not in a coven. And so it definitely feels separate, which is, I've never thought about that. Like, I've never thought that, even though I deal with people all the time who do the same sorts of things as I do, I don't talk about it. And I don't know why. I find it very scary to acknowledge it publicly, almost. I don't know.
It's, you know, witches with persecution. No, never. Like, that's fair. Like, but it's interesting because, like, I was rereading one of your chapbooks recently, Warlock. And what's that?
Thank you for reading it.
Oh, yeah. No, I love your work. But, like, it was interesting. So, like, the ways in which magic and witchcraft can sort of, like, be in the air of writing, but not necessarily be in the sort of confession. Because, like, I know one of the articles Luna Luna did fairly recently was a confession from someone who had done black magic and felt a certain measure of remorse about that.
Yeah.
And I, like, that's very direct. Like, here's
awesome
me
piece.
Doing magic. But, like, actually, would you mind reading, like, the first couple bits of this copy of Warlock, which I'm handing to you through a nest of wires, because we are in a basement radio station.
A dark, scary basement.
At some point, you need to take pictures of this, because this is all coming to an... Oh, I'm going to make that announcement later. Never mind.
Cool.
Suspense. But, yeah, if you would, please.
Sure. I'll read two pages.
That sounds great.
Okay, cool. I should say that this whole book, Warlock, is about an ex-boyfriend, and this is my spell to sort of rid myself of him and his old energies. Many years ago. It's gone now. Under old velvet, I am warlocked, pregnant with something other. First I was me, and then there was you. And after my departure from you, it came out of me, the black hole. And which to say I will recover my graces, but no time soon. It's still true. Twin windows hunched over, weeping, my only friends. No one sent the postcard, amore mio. No one sent the news. A funeral I am invited, two hands in a bucket of soot. My gown self. I clean my face to present for you a black water bucket. You come home and say nothing, warlock. You stumble in and say nothing, warlock. And me, I am here waiting, as you like me, your own autumn.
That's really wonderful. It feels weird to clap in a room with just two of us when we do it.
Thank you.
So what's really interesting about that is, like, I mean, partly the idea that, like, witchcraft is this sort of, like, there's a sense that, like, magic is a kind of bodily transformation. But also, I didn't realize that you were writing that itself was kind of a ritual or a rite.
Yeah, definitely.
Did you, like, conceive of it initially as that, or did it just sort of, like, become that as you were doing it?
Yeah, it wasn't my intention. I actually intended on making this ex of mine into the warlock who had this, like, enchanting power over me and who destroyed me for many years, I think, from the inside out. And as I was writing it, it's almost like I siphoned this warlock, this evil trope I created, siphoned his power back into myself. And halfway through writing it, I realized, actually, this is my fucking spell. And am I allowed to curse?
Oh, absolutely. The FCC has no power over us.
Sweet. Okay.
You can, I'm trying to think if there are any things you can't do on this show.
Tell me them all, because I'll do them.
There are none.
Cool.
We are in total freedom. Oh, how horrifying is that? Sorry, keep going. Sorry, we're getting sidetracked.
Yeah,
this is my fault.
I realized that I was sort of taking back the power that I gave him by calling him a warlock, and in fact was sort of reborn as a witch through this ritual that gave me the power and allowed me to put a spell on him to eradicate him forever. And I also just made a Love Witch reference right there.
That is, we should honestly talk about that movie, because that movie is a lot of fun.
Yes.
But so eradicating him forever, in terms of your own sort of emotional universe that you're operating under, or did he Is he dead?
No, God, no.
Oh, okay.
No, no, cool. He's not dead. I wish him well. I do not mean to say I eradicate him as in, like, I want him gone from the earth or anything bad to happen. I just mean I eradicate the energy that was him and was attached to me, and that kind of made me sick mentally and physically. But not. I wish all people well.
Okay. I mean, that makes sense, because, like, I feel like the people we know, when they exit our lives in certain ways, do sort of become the ghosts that haunt the houses of ourselves.
Oh, that's beautiful. And yes. Yeah.
Thank you. So that's really okay. So how often is writing a ritualistic act for you? Like, do you ever incorporate writing within the sort of just more rituals that you do on a regular basis?
Yes. Writing is consistently ritualized for me. Actually, you know, it really is. Now that I think about it, I anoint myself with an oil when I really want to sit down and write. And there's a special oil that I use. It comes from Catland. That's a plug. I anoint myself with this oil. I usually light a candle, some sort of color that I've invented for myself to symbolize something that I've associated with that color. I don't really go by the rules with, like, green is money, red is love. I sort of create my own because I think that's where the power is. And then I sit down and I write. And often, if I really want something published, or if I'm super, like, excited about a publisher getting back to me, I'll, like, write a little, I don't know, incantation and speak it and then bury it in something and hope it grows. And actually, I've been lucky. And, you know, part of that is, like, I wrote an okay poem. But part of it, I think, is that, like, I created a channel for them to be open to my work.
That is really cool. That's actually a thing that I do too as a writer. And I always feel like I'm kind of like, it's weird because it kind of feels like cheating a little bit. But at the same time, you're also just like, they're going to publish it or not based on how good it is. You're just like, sometimes people are in the right mood for things or not, you know?
Like, maybe the right person opens up Submittable that night and checks the submissions.
Right. Who's reading the slush pile
who's
today?
Doing it.
Yeah. Which is interesting. I tend to do it with sigils. Like, I've made a sigil particularly for this, which is, I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm always more of a sigil person, but that's also because, like, that was the first thing, you know. We were talking, I think, last night about, like, me getting into chaos magic through Batman and how that's kind of embarrassing, but I am glad it happened because it got me to where I am today.
That's great.
But back to you, who is more interesting.
No way.
I mean, at least personally to me, because I already know the things about me. So you've got this novella that's coming out from Clash Books, all caps. Can you talk about, like, because it, I know it takes place in New Orleans, which is kind of like, I think it was the most haunted city in America.
Yeah.
With the whole, you know, there's that convent full of vampire nuns and stuff
windows,
that they had to like use 9-inch nails to act literal nails, not the Trent Reznor band, to keep them trapped, and like that's really cool. But anyway, so like that's about, it's a haunted place.
Yes.
So tell me about that.
Oh man, so I've been to New Orleans a bunch of times, and every time I feel like there's such a residue of energy kind of lingering on me. And my brother moved there, so he lives in East New Orleans, and he works in the French Quarter. So I've seen kind of all parts of New Orleans, from the touristy part to the not-so-touristy part. And every time I go there, I feel like I'm going to collapse, just implode and go crazy, because there's so much energy there, and it's intense as fuck. But, you know, I stepped back and thought, how much of this is me projecting it onto the city? Is the tourist trap of like the voodoo shops kind of like leaking into my psyche and making me think that it's really a haunted place, or does it have some sort of power? So the more I visited, and the last time I saw my brother, I had a meltdown. I was just depressed. I felt like there was so much to the city that was seeping into my bones. And I, you know, in fact, I do think it's a really haunted city, and it really does have a lot of power, and it's a magnetic place. So I started writing a book a few years ago, like a murder story, which is ridiculous because I am not a crime writer in the slightest. And I submitted it to the publisher, Clash Books, Lisa and Christoph. Thank you for publishing my book.
Check out Lisa on episode 11 of the show, 13, one of the old ones.
Yeah, it was a great one. And they were like, hey, you're not a crime writer. Let's cut this shit out. So they just took out the crime element of the book. But they kept in the main premise, which is it's about a girl who is in New Orleans who is trying to move through a series of deaths that occurred in her life, but she's totally and like irrevocably fucking lost to these ideas of death, and she's just obsessing, and the necro is just all over her. So it's a great city for her to explore that and move through it, and I guess it's a autobiographical in some way.
Okay, cool. And I mean, so this is talking about that sort of like these themes of magic and haunting and death, but was there any sort of ritualistic aspect to the writing of this as well, or it's okay to say no?
Well, in the past there was no ritualistic element to it. I was just writing it over a long summer and it was probably not very, very good. And then now that I'm editing it and sitting and I'm changing the tense it's written in, I'm changing what I had from past to present and writing a bunch of new copy for it. Yeah, I totally do ritualize it. I sit down and I pick the nights that I'm going to write. And like I said before, I like anoint myself with my special writing oil and I go for it. And I tell myself, you have to do 3,500 words or all your magic will be zapped from your body and you'll never be a witch again.
Those are high stakes.
High.
That's really intense. So when's that coming out? Do you have a date for that yet?
We talked about it yesterday, actually, and we're thinking spring 2019, so it's a while from now. But I have another book coming out before then, so it's kind of good because I'll be able to, you know, do my thing with both.
Cool.
Yeah.
Is that the one? That's the one you can't talk about, right?
I can say a little. My best friend, Alyssa Moorhart Goldstein, she and I co-wrote a collaborative prose poetry collection together, and It's being published next year in the winter, but my publisher is awesome and they're making like super special announcement videos, so I can't say who they are, but they're awesome and it's cool.
Well, that's super cool. Congratulations on that and all the success. So that actually is a good segue into a thing that I wanted to talk about on this show and get your sort of read on it, because it involves magic and involves writers, but what's also interesting is that idea of like shifting tense in something. So there was this thing I found out about this week where William S. Burroughs, the novelist, apparently was very upset at a coffee shop in London, I think in part because it embodied the gentrification of his neighborhood. And so he just saw it as like a sign of that evil. But like also, I guess he accused them of poisoning him with their cheesecake. And so he did this magical operation where he would go into the coffee shop. He would record sound, like ambient sound of the coffee shop and take photos. And then he would go back a few days later and play that sound as a way of attempting to destroy that coffee shop's link with time, to sort of like wrap it in time or push it out of time. And he said of this quote, "Now, to apply the three tape recorder analogy to this simple operation, tape recorder 2 is my recording of the Mocha Bar vicinity. These recordings are access. Tape recorder 2 in the Garden of Eden was Eve made from Adam. So recording made from the Mocha Bar is a piece of the Mocha Bar. The recording once made, this piece becomes autonomous and out of their control. Tape recorder 3 is playback. Adam experiences shame when his disgraceful behavior is played back to him by the tape recorder 3, which is God. By playing back my recordings to the Mocha Bar, when I want, and with any changes I wish to make to the recordings, I become God for the locale. I affect them. They cannot affect me." Awesome. Oh,
so metal.
Also, yes. Also, that coffee shop did close down and become a store, I think, called Royal Treats or something like that. But like, so how do you feel about the importance of like time, the importance of editing as a kind of magic? Like, give me a response to William S. Burroughs and his behavior.
Oh my God. I love that you're interested in this. I had to read it several times to wrap my mind around that. First of all, I think it's rad that he is the cut up technique that he uses of recording different places and then overlapping them and trying to change their place in time. I think that's awesome. I think he's crazy. And I like crazy. I think crazy is okay, but I think he's nuts. yeah, I think it's great. I think time is actually, man, that's such a big question. I have so many answers and I don't even think I could give them to you all here. I think time is a super key element in everything. You're waiting for something to manifest. You are, when you're, you know, looking at tarot cards, you're looking into the future, you're gleaning something from the past, you're grounding yourself in the present. And yeah, I think like working with ideas of time allows you to sort of transcend the moment and really have like a grasp on all of it. I don't think his like magical operation makes any sense, but I love the idea of it.
I mean, I really like the, I mean, it's interesting because I think he tried something similar to try to defeat the Church of Scientology. And I mean, that's still going strong. But I mean, you know, sometimes they're also there. They're like a coffee shop isn't really trying to wield the belief of many people. So like they're kind of defenseless against magic, I guess.
It was very malicious in my opinion.
He seems like a malicious guy.
Totally.
Like totally. I'm pretty sure when he shot his wife, that wasn't an accident, even though they were playing William Tell, which is also like such a nasty way to like, anyway, it's also just interesting from like the standpoint of like how much of magic involves like sort of looking behind the face of reality and kind of jumping off the map of reality. And like part of that is time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that sort of relationship.
And by the way, did you see the Louis Theroux documentary on Scientology?
No.
It's amazing.
Is that the one where he gets in that argument with like, where they're like, stop filming us,
yes.
But they're filming him.
Yes.
I saw the trailer, and the trailer was very exciting.
It's such a good documentary, and he's so amazing because he's the best documentarian. That's the word, right?
It sounds good.
Documentarist. Yeah, that's a rad documentary.
Okay.
You learn a lot.
Actually, since we're talking about film, also, since we're at the halfway mark for the show, I should remind you, you're listening to Into the Dark on Radio Free Brooklyn. It's this radio station. You're listening to it now. I always feel like I'm supposed to say more, but there's really nothing more to be, you know, we're in a basement. Hooray, Brooklyn. But like popular depictions of witchcraft, because we were talking about the Love Witch. And how do you feel about, because I feel like there has been a renaissance, because like in the 60s, you had a ton of British horror movies about witches, including the trailer we played at the beginning of this episode. I think that's an American film. And now like in the 90s, you sort of had, as like people our age were becoming self-aware, like you had Sabrina the Teenage Witch, you had The Craft, and then like there's
been Charmed.
You had Charmed, and like how do you feel about these sort of like these popular depictions?
I mean, you know, I understand when people say things like it's not real, the way that they're depicting it isn't real, this is not really what this is not really how a spell would go, or this is an oversimplification, it's playing on like archetypes that aren't necessarily like 100% accurate. And that's true. All of that is super legitimate. But I think there's a place for these sorts of movies and shows, albeit mainstream. And that's because I think these women all have one thing in common. They're strong, they're smart, and they want to get what they want. And I think that's awesome. And if it means like, you know, rejiggering the depiction of witches to fit a more mainstream audience, I think that's great because it breaks the stigma and it lets people in behind the curtain to see that there's a whole world out here that isn't just Jesus and, you know, other religions that are sometimes stuffed down your throat, that there's more to it and you can learn it and that it's about, you know, personal power.
Yeah.
I think it's great.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's also just like an act of reclamation, right? Because you have so many of these like these tropes that are like not real were still used in very malicious ways. Like the consequences of them were real. So like to defeat those projections is a great act of safety. So the Love Witch though in particular, because you interviewed the director thereof.
Yes, Anna Biller, yeah.
And how did you like for people who haven't seen it, like could you give like a 30-second description of like what that movie's sort of aesthetic deal is?
Okay, here's my elevator description. The Love Witch is about a woman who has a series of shitty relationships. Dudes screw over in really chauvinist ways. So she is like reborn as a witch, as she says, in an effort to get love and use sex to get love. So she just really needs to find a soulmate and a man to love her. That's her whole thing. But there's a bunch of other like foil characters that kind of come through the movie to show her that like having a prince in the end isn't everything. And so it's a kind of, it's the movie's all about the push and pull of wanting love and being a feminist and using your power for good and also for manipulation that ultimately only hurts you in the end.
Okay, that's great.
Sorry, that was way more than 30 seconds.
That's fine. We've got 20 minutes left in the show. So like, take all the time. You're here to talk. Anyway, but like, so would you say that this film is a feminist film?
120%. And I think if anyone said otherwise, they weren't watching it correctly. I think there's a lot of like plot points that make you think it's not feminist. For example, the main character is super intensely into finding a guy to love her. And everything that we're taught is that there's no prince. He's not going to come and save you and stop looking for that because it should be about you. And that's fine. But the whole movie is designed to make you think about these things. It's not like that the main character is right or wrong. It's that they're creating a movie that really shows like the numbers society has done on women and the flawed ways of thinking that I think we've like internalized as a result. So yeah, it's totally feminist.
And would you say that like the magic in that film plays a role in its feminism?
Oh yeah, I do. I think so for sure. The magic in that movie is beautiful and soft and sweet. Like she creates like candles and mixes colors, and she wears clothes that are actually magical clothes that she's made herself. And I think there's a lot of feminine power there. That's like super worth probably like a whole other radio show talking about.
That's awesome. What do you think is sort of the broader intersection of feminism and magic? Like, cause I feel like a lot of the people I see who are sort of becoming witches and doing witchcraft, like they often are uniting that magic with social change and a desire for social change.
Yeah, no, totally. I wrote an article for Refinery29 about how women primarily are using witchcraft to kind of like encounter dark times, especially, you know, with the kind of like political climate we have where our president is basically telling us like we're worthless. I think that the intersection is that we're trying to reclaim our power and to like tap into some greater force that's intuitive and emotional, all the things that women have been told to stop, you know, stop being emotional, stop being sensitive. I think it's that very thing that we're tapping into now and saying like, fuck you guys, I'm going to use this like amazing magic that we have kind of, that's inborn, and go with it. And I also think witchcraft is free. So in a sense, like you can, you know, instead of paying for therapy or instead of like dropping a bunch of money on X, Y, or Z, I think there's a way of like taking back your power, and no matter your place in society, you're able to kind of create a ritual for yourself.
That's fantastic. I mean, yeah, because you were saying like the one of the primary tools you use in magic is water, which, you know, comes out the tap.
Yeah, it's free.
That's really fantastic. So actually, that's interesting. So like, because you, I think, have done a lot to sort of think about the relationship between ritual and magic and trauma in particular.
Yeah.
And grief. And like, so like, could you expect, because I mean, you mentioned the sort of therapeutic aspects.
Like,
what's some good maybe advice for someone who's looking for a kind of a way to sort of center themselves around things like this for therapeutic purposes?
That's a super great question. There's so much I could say here, but I will just like quickly say that lately I've been going through a grief process for various different reasons. I've like lost people, or people are actively dying or sick. So I've been in kind of a hole emotionally. And I'm not necessarily a believer in an afterlife, find it very difficult to find peace with everything because I'm so uncertain. But I'm sad and I feel out of control and I feel desperate, as grief makes you feel. But luckily with ritual, I think, and especially writing rituals as I use them, I think there's a real way to tap into something insanely beautiful about death. I write out all my feelings, all my thoughts, all my notes to the dead. I write letters to the dead in a special journal of mine. And that's my way of communicating. And once I get to the bottom of that barrel of all the exhaustive emotion, I'm able to see death for what it is, which is a process. It's a ritual itself. It's that we just blip into existence and leave. And it's beautiful. And you have to respect that. So we are literally living inside of the universe's ritual of come and go. And I think that's amazing. And to just honor being here and to honor the people that were here and know that they had to leave. And that's just the way it is. So, I think creating rituals to help you ground yourself and center yourself and respect the process of living and dying can really kind of be freeing. It doesn't take away the pain, but it helps find clarity.
That was really good. Thank you for saying that.
Thank you for asking.
Sorry,
I'm such a fucking bummer.
You're not a come now. I was going to ask you about death, because you do sort of talk sometimes about the magic of death and sort of acquainting yourself with it. But this is interesting to me because it kind of circles back to the beginning of this conversation where you mentioned that you sort of, in a lot of ways, sort of gain grounding and ritual with the Eucharist, which is, you know, Christianity in many ways is a death-oriented religion. And do you still find, when you look for like ritualistic acts to sort of better orient yourself with death in a relationship with death, do the old sort of trappings of, because I mean, you don't identify as Catholic, but I know a lot of people who are witches who have some sort of like Judeo-Christian background, and they sort of incorporate aspects of it without necessarily considering themselves Christian. Like hoodoo will use saints all the time. Like, do you find yourself ever coming back to Christian elements, if not necessarily like corresponding to a belief in God?
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess I do. And maybe I don't always like give the Christians the credit in those moments. But I think thinking about it, it's become ingrained in me so much. I guess I should have mentioned this earlier, but part of my whole ritual for things, I do drink a lot of red wine. And I think I often do rituals in which I have a glass of red wine for lots of reasons, probably to calm down, but also because it definitely in my mind still represents the blood of the blood of this deity. And for me, I think it still represents, it signifies like the beginning of a ritual. It signifies that this is a ritual, and B, it's, literally of the earth. And because it's so, wrapped up in, blood, it just feels like it is literally like the life force that I am drinking and am using that to like manifest something.
Right.
So, I think wine definitely played a part in that.
That's really, actually, now that you mentioned that, it makes me think about like, because like we've been talking about like magic as like an internal transformation kind of thing in a lot of ways. And like wine is a weird metaphor for that, just because the yeast that makes grape juice into wine is usually, I think, found either in or on the grapes already.
Yes.
So you like that idea of like, it was always there waiting to just spring.
It's so true, and it's so amazing. And have you, if you're a listener of Tool?
I have been.
Okay.
There was that phase in my life.
Oh my God, I still am in that phase. But I know that, you know, Maynard James Keenan, the singer from Tool, like when he went and created a vineyard out in Arizona, he created a documentary called Blood Into Wine, and he like scattered the ashes of his mother, Judith, throughout these like vineyards, and out bloom the wine that he named Judith. And I think that's really beautiful. And I've always kind of held wine in this holy regard, in that it has some sort of like potential for resurrection. I don't know.
I mean, that's, you know, that's an old story. I mean, there's even like when we talk about like sort of resurrection gods, one of the early ones is Dionysus, who was
the wine god.
Though I don't know. I mean, I feel like there's also something to be said for just like alcohol ritualistically used. Because like I, you know, when I do rituals, sometimes I will also usually something less classy. Like I'll get like three tecates or whatever, you know, and like, but just like just the idea of like shifting your awareness a little bit is really, I think, helpful. And I mean, like, but you can do that in all sorts of ways. You can be a sober witch. It's okay. No one's judging you.
No, totally not. You can be a sober witch.
Cool. Yeah. I'm glad that's a nice PSA put in there.
We love you, sober witches.
We really do. Also, you know, smoke weed. It's fine. It's all fine.
All of the things.
You know.
Don't hurt yourself too badly, though.
It's, you decide what to do with you. You have autonomy, which it's good to say that out loud explicitly every now and again, you know,
because you can have autonomy. Yes.
Yeah. Own it. Anyway, yeah. So, okay. We've talked about ritual. We've talked about wine. We've talked about death.
It's like your only conversations with me ever.
I mean, they're good conversations. what else do I have in my notes here? Oh man.
I can ask you questions.
If you want to. I mean, that does feel good as like a way of just like, cause I've been thinking about like the idea of like before this show, you know what? I'm just going to say it. You know what? I've been hiding it like a poison pill. So, hey everybody. So thank you for listening to Into the Dark for as long as you've been doing. When this season of Radio for Brooklyn is over, the show is ending. It's been good. It's been grand. But sometimes it's better if a thing feels like it's ending too soon. But that's not to say that we're going to be losing energy at all, because we're having like Lisa's here, and like I've lined up a bunch of really swell interviews. So like we're gonna hit the brick wall at the end of the season at full speed and destroy ourselves into a cloud of glitter instead of slowly withering away. And that's the point. And that's the excitement. So heads up.
That's great.
Thank you for listening. Like, I really appreciate that. But this show is still going on, which is why I've now turned on slide guitar. So, actually, that's interesting. So, like, music.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And, like, witchcraft. Because, like, there's that old association between witchcraft and rock and roll and stuff. But, like, do you ever incorporate sound or music into your rituals, a la our friend William S. Burroughs, or even actually, so I found out about that through Lucas, Douglas Lucas, who is a fellow that I interviewed a long time ago, who did a lot of sonic sigils.
Love that.
Yeah, no, he's super cool. But like, do you ever incorporate music or things like that to get like even just get into the headspace for it?
Yeah, totally. Well, there's two things I've been doing. One is I do listen to music. Sometimes I listen to chanting. But the other cool thing that I'm doing right now, my friend who I wrote a collaborative book with, she and I write out our poetry onto Excel sheets and overlap certain lines and then record ourselves speaking the poems, and they become like this beautiful chant-like thing, and each poem is sort of like a spell, and we're going to try and perform this at our show, which we produce. It's called Diorama, and I shouldn't have said all of that, but yeah, we totally use poetry and sound to like unite the bodies and unite like everyone in the room. And I think there's something really powerful and beautiful and magical about that.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
But I also blast a lot of really loud, like a really loud metal in my house by myself and get into the mindset too. So yeah, I love music.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And it's interesting, like the transformative aspect of, especially like listening to the same thing over and over again. Cause like I've used the electromagnetic signature of mercury, like as a sound recording, like in rituals, and just like having that playing and just having that take over even like the background of things. Like that's the platform on which you're working.
I love that.
You should check it out. It's incredibly creepy, and it's on YouTube, so it's very easy to find.
You know what was also very creepy? You sent me the recordings of those like World War II broadcasts.
Oh, the number stations?
Yes, the number stations.
Yeah, those are really fun too.
Those were the creepiest thing I've ever listened to.
Yeah. For people who don't who need some background on this, so, like number stations are a practice that I think might actually still be going on, where basically ham radio stations across mostly Europe would send out recordings of people saying numbers, usually with some sort of music cue to indicate that the broadcast was going to happen. And these numbers would correspond to codes that only spies would have. and would give them information, but a lot of them are deeply creepy.
So creepy. There was one with like a child speaking and flamenco music.
Yeah.
So good.
Actually, speaking of creepy things, which children are, I think, invariably. So, graveyards.
Yes.
Do you ever incorporate graveyards? Because I know you're putting together a thing, and maybe it's too early to talk about that, but you're putting together a sort of an experience with Atlas Obscura in a graveyard.
Yeah.
This October.
Yes. So the show that my friend Alyssa and I produced, Diorama, we're going to be taking part in Atlas Obscura's Into the Veil. And that happens October 13th and 14th. I think that those are the dates. We're going to be taking over a mausoleum and the space outside of the mausoleum. And we're going to be utilizing poetry and the sound poetry I was talking about to kind of like guide people through some sort of experience. I'll stop there because I probably said too much already. But yes, I think graveyards are amazing because it's just potent energy that you're able to connect with the dead. You're able to visit them. You're able to learn from them and just be there and like hone your powers. And I think there's something just incredible about it. And I was thinking I should probably go and do more writing in a graveyard.
Yeah.
I know that sounds super morbid, but I mean, that's a place of history and there's so much energy there. I think you could only benefit from it.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because like, you were talking about the idea that like you need to sort of have a better relationship with death and not be afraid of it and not have it make you sad. So like, I mean, just naturalizing that in your life, like having like, hey, look,
yeah,
there it is again.
Yeah. That's like a big part of the death positivity movement. And I've been kind of getting more and more involved in those like tenets of death positivity.
Could you talk more about like, cause I feel like there are a lot of people who might be unfamiliar with that phrase. Like, what is death positivity?
So I might not like sum it up perfectly because I know that there's a lot of definitions out there already that are perfect. There's a great place called Death Salon. You should definitely check that out for more information on death positivity. But essentially, it's the idea that you are normalizing death and that you are confronting it head on and that you're not kind of hiding from it or having it be a shadow thing or having it be this untouchable topic that just breaks your heart. It's an ordinary part of life. Bodies die. Bodies decay. Loss happens. And I don't think death positivity is a way of like getting over the pain, but it's a way of normalizing death so that it becomes less like a secret. Because, you know, there's a lot of people who don't want to talk about it. And you kind of move through your life and it's just a scary, crazy, big thing. But if you welcome it a little bit more, I think it makes your life more beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's something to be said for like the loss of public mourning. Yeah. The way we used to, because I mean, like, there used to be like, I mean, maybe we don't need to go back to like the heavily codified and rigid ways of doing that, like in Victorian England, where like you, depending upon your relationship with somebody, you would have to wear like a certain shade of black for a certain period of time. But like something about being able to sort of have that be a thing that you say and don't say.
Right. That's true. I mean, like in New Orleans, they have just like processions through the streets with a band. And I think that's awesome. Yeah. They do it for weddings too, but I don't know, parading through the streets to celebrate someone's life. I think that says out loud, like, hey, death is here. It's going to happen. And let's look at all aspects of it. It's not just an ending. It's also sort of a celebration. And maybe it's also a time for us to evaluate the fact that we're here and it's like glorious that we're given this opportunity.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, when I think about like what my own funeral should be like, and I'm telling enough as many people about this as possible because I won't be able to tell them when I'm dead.
Noted.
I would very much like Wanted Dead or Alive played at my funeral.
Really?
Maybe with like my body put into like a hot tub instead of like an open casket, depending upon like how much of it is left and like what's like, you know, because...
Right.
But like that idea of like maybe put some sunglasses on my corpse, like just make it fun.
Yeah.
Make it a party.
Yeah.
Like even just like have me like on a couch and have everyone just sort of ignore me.
Just have fun around you.
Exactly.
So, I like it.
Cool. Yeah. Because like, I mean, funerals don't have to be, I mean, they're going to be sad, but you can be sad and enjoy a thing at the same time.
You definitely can. And it's such a weird idea to like find that balance. I mean, God, it's fucking hard.
I mean, that like last show that we walked into the last like 5 minutes of before this one, like they were talking about like crying during movies or crying during TV shows.
Yeah.
And like, I didn't want to like jump in because it's their show or whatever, but like I cry during movies, but like often during kind of like ones that have been like, the first movie I think I cried during was a hockey movie.
Oh yeah.
Where like, it was just sort of like the protagonist was like this very sweet, kind person. And he was deeply injured trying to protect, just trying to prevent like a goal so his team could win because he just loved his teammates so much. Aww. And like there was a moment of just weeping of just like, they're hurting our special boy. Oh, oh my God. But like that, you know, like became a film that I was very deeply touched by because it made me cry and that joy of sadness.
Yes, that's, I mean, I think it's okay to cry. And I mean, I heard what she said. She said it's like when something is not real, like it doesn't emotionally affect you. But the thing is, everything that happens on TV shows have happened somewhere.
Yeah.
Like that boy in the hockey movie, like he's, there's a boy out there who's playing hockey and he's hurt and you want him to win.
They hurt our special boy.
I cried last night during an episode of Star Trek where Worf delivered a baby and he's like this big, strong man. And he's like, okay, push. And the baby's born. He's like, congratulations. And it was just so touching that this like stoic man could deliver a little baby. I cried a lot.
That's God. Good old Worf. Love that forehead. So do you like with the creation of like fiction and sort of scenarios, do you feel like you are creating a kind of reality in that situation? Like, is a fictional thing a certain kind of real? I'm throwing this out here because I'm curious, but like I also don't have fully formed thoughts on to answer this myself.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, it's a kind of real. That's why I cry during TV shows and whatever else, because I do think everything has already happened. So when you see like a movie of someone being tortured, you know that that's the sort of pain somebody somewhere felt at some point. But yeah, when I'm writing, I do think I'm trying to, I don't think I'll ever be the kind of writer that writes like bizarre fiction or anything that's like even remotely not based in reality. I like to write about reality. I guess I'm creating a reality which allows me to confront the things that I maybe didn't confront in my own reality.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think like half of my writing is like guilt driven.
Guilt driven as in like because you didn't
feel
like you're sort of recreating a situation as a way you would have preferred to have done it, or?
Yes, or treat a character in a way that like I think they should have been treated, or like approach a situation in a way that maybe I should have approached it. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I really do think like half of everything I write is just me saying, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
That's very relatable to me as a writer as well. So that's...
Yeah, I think you've talked about guilt.
A lot.
And shame.
I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, Catholicism, how are you doing?
Thanks for doing this to us.
I mean, it could be worse, but... I just tried to think of how, but I'm having trouble. Puritanism, that's worse because they make you wear buckles and not in the fun way. Okay, so like this sense of like creating a world that is like our own, but it's not our own. Have you ever found yourself sort of drifting into these created worlds? Like, could you like project something and then kind of make it that reality?
Yes.
Cool.
Totally.
That was such a shot in the dark. I'm so glad the answer is yes. Please go on. Yes.
No, yeah. I actually hadn't thought about it. And then you said it and it dawned on me. Yes, totally. That's the answer.
Go on.
Okay. So there's the book that my friend and I wrote together that's coming out. It's called Nympholepsy. It's about like a time in which we like performed with a certain kind of like theater group. And it's totally like autobiographical in some ways, but also a lot of the scenes that I interwoven with what really happened are scenes that I wish would have happened. So again, it's like the idea of time overlapping with itself. So it's like the past and this like hypothetical fucking present that I wish existed. That allows me to like project. I think a lot of people project into their characters and their scenarios as a way of like putting something to bed or like indulging something in themselves because they feel bad.
So that troupe you were a part of, like you adopted a persona while you were doing that to some extent. Like, do you when you like, do you feel like there's a something to be said for the ritualistic aspects of Persona?
Oh my God, another great question. Thank you, Cooper.
Thank you.
Yes, I super do, because I think like I have an alternate ego. Not that she's like another personality in my mind, but she's definitely this part of me that like can't exist in the daytime because it's a terrible thing and society wouldn't accept her. But when I write, I often write from her perspective. And I think it's not a character poem. It's like, it's me. It's just the part of me that like is filtered through her. And we're the same, kind of like Jesus and God and the spirit or whatever. But we're different. And like I conjure her and she conjures me sometimes. The answer is I totally ritualize Persona. Yeah.
Cool. And like when you do performances now as a writer, like, I mean, you do readings and things of that sort. Like, who is that on stage?
It's me. Okay. I think it's me. But I do like feel a certain sense of branding, but I fucking hate that. And I like strive so hard not to give into it. But
I mean, branding is the real dark magic.
Yeah, for real. It's bad. It's bad news. I feel like the person that people think I am after reading my writing like needs to be presented when I'm at a reading. It's really ridiculous. And maybe I'm not that person that day, and that's okay too.
That isn't, 'cause that almost feels like a broader version or like a more acute version of just like the notion of professionalism.
Yeah.
Where you have to be a sort of effaced but cheerful version of yourself if you're going to be in an office or an office style setting. So the next show just opened the door, which means that we're actually running out of time. So before we close up shop on this episode, with the knowledge that there are about 4 or 5 left before Into the Dark goes into the dark, I guess. Is there anything like, because we've talked about things, but like just like where can people find out stuff about you? Where can they find out stuff about what you're doing? Where can they learn the stuff you're up to?
Cool. So people can check out Luna Luna, the magazine, at lunalunamagazine.com. Hope you do. We're all over social, and please follow us. We have amazing contributors. I'm very grateful for all of them. You can find me at Lisa M. Basile. That's LISAMBASILE .com. I'm also all over social. I'm the only person on the internet that looks like Wednesday Addams with my name, so you can find me.
Nice.
And yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being on. And also, I should say that since we are running up on the end of things, you do still have time to submit questions to our research department. So if you have a question about witchcraft, the occult, the history thereof, applications, just looking for a spell for something, please do hit us up at intothedarkrfb@gmail.com. RFB because you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. Stay tuned for the next show. And, you know, keep listening to these upcoming episodes because time is running out. Like, I basically put a call out, like, who wants to be on this show but hasn't had a chance to yet? So, like, some heavy hitters are like Lisa, for example, are coming out to swing the sledgehammer at this thing as it comes a tumbling down. And what a sweet, sweet release that death will be. Not that I haven't enjoyed it. I'm just saying, like, you know, it's just you have to enjoy the tension release that is the death urge coming to its full fruit. Not to go full Freud on everything. Freud being, I believe you said in a Luna Luna article, not you, but the writer of the Luna, Freud was the enemy of the clitoris or something like that?
Yeah, I think that was definitely in there.
Right, but enemy of the clitoris, champion of the death urge. Keep listening to Radio Free Brooklyn for all your needs along that spectrum of death and orgasm, which, you know, is it Le Petit More or is it just a better life? Thanks, guys.
Bye.